What happens when we die? Do we simply cease to be? Or do we survive in some form?
There's millions of Americans that have had a near-death experience. They're not rare. When I first heard about near-death experiences, I thought they were so fantastic that I wanted to believe this, but an extraordinary claim like that requires extraordinary evidence.
I certainly understand people's skepticism about this. If it hadn't happened to me, I'd be skeptical about it too.
I sat there and thought to myself, this story just sounds crazy. This just, nobody's going to believe this. I mean, I was a pretty big spiritual skeptic, and to say those things or to even think about that experience was just, it was a lot for me to take in.
I did not want to believe this, but I've been in the presence of dying people more than any skeptic I've ever met.
Were you a skeptic before this?
Yes.
You were?
Yes, I was working with cancer patients prior to this happening. They would tell me they saw things, and they would say, can you see them? And I'd say, no, I can't see them. Then I would leave the room and tell the resident, you better check their morphine.
The scientific side of me could not see how that could be, and yet it was a very, very powerful memory. I do not believe that there is a good neurophysiologic explanation for what happened to me.
Evan Alexander's experience was profound and life-altering, but it is by no means unique.
Well, out of 1,300 near-death experiences that I've studied, Mary Jo's experience is absolutely typical of what people describe.
I saw this light, and it was kind of off in the distance. And my husband was by my bed, and I saw that light. And then I remember kind of looking at him. So I was like, okay, so I see this light, but I'm not dreaming. And I was thinking, is that the tunnel that the cancer patients used to tell me about? It was so small. And then all of a sudden, it came larger, and I folded into it. And I was in it.
It is by no means unique.
If near-death experiences were culturally determined, then people that had never heard of near-death experiences would have a different experience. But we're not finding that. Whether you know or don't know about near-death experience, the time it happens has no effect on whether the experience happens or not or what the content is.
So based on your data, What is the proof?
Those that are blind, including blind from birth, can have visual near-death experience.
Vicky Nuratuk had been blind from birth.
I was at Harborview Medical Center and looking down at everything that was happening. Initially, it was pretty scary. I finally recognized my wedding ring and my hair, and I thought, is this my body? I went up through the ceiling as if it were nothing. I was overwhelmed by that experience because I couldn't really imagine what light was like.
My research involved a study of young children age 5 and under, and I found the content of their near-death experiences absolutely identical to older children and adults, suggesting that whether you know about near-death experiences, what your cultural upbringing is, what your awareness of death is, doesn't seem to have any effect.
Colton was 4 with a near tragedy. What they thought was the flu turned out to be a burst appendix.
Colton, today, so you're 11, this all happened to you when you were 4.
He began speaking about things he couldn't possibly know about. His mother's miscarriage, his father's prayers.
When he told us about his sister in heaven, another one of those holy cow moments.
How would you explain it to a 3-year-old that a baby died in your tummy?
Okay, he can't make this up. He can't invent this. No memory was planted. He could tell me where I was while he was in surgery. The surgeon couldn't tell me that. The nurses in there couldn't. My wife couldn't tell me where I was praying, but he could tell me.
The problem with all of these physiological explanations is that they don't account for the complex thinking, the memory formation, the perceptions that take place when we know the brain is not capable of doing complex thinking.
If it is possible to think while flatlined, afterlife is proven. The 9 evidences that prove the reality of life after death, a game changer for the science of near-death experiences.
Waking up to more than what we see on the planet right now.
Evidence number 7, near-death experiences. Following the near-death experience, 91% of near-death experiencers reported changes in attitudes or beliefs. These changes may cause conflicts with loved ones, family, and friends.
Can you put yourself in the shoes of someone who's had a near-death experience? As soon as they start to recover and get over this incredible traumatic event, there's a lot going on in their mind. They may not even know for sure that they're going to survive and go on living.
I was sort of overloaded with what had just happened with me. It was though I was an appliance built for 110 volts plugged into 220.
I went through a long period of not wanting to tell hardly anybody about it.
And I decided then to just not say anything about it, because it just sounded too crazy to me.
I had to settle for myself whether or not I had had a psychotic episode.
The near-death experience is so profoundly different from anything that they ever experienced in their life. Very, very difficult for these near-death experiencers to slowly start to have the courage to share this with other people.
And what I think is more interesting in my life is what happened after the light. I changed. I wound up in graduate school of social work, going into the field of death and dying. A good fit. I wasn't afraid of death. Wonder why.
The number one thing is that they come back and they do not have a fear of death.
The fear of death is certainly gone, and when it comes my time to go, I'm ready.
Evidence number 8, near-death experiences. 54% of near-death experiencers report psychic or other paranormal abilities after experiencing a near-death experience.
Some people do come back endowed by special gifts. Very often these gifts are described as being of increasing sensitivity to other people, sort of an intuitiveness that operates at a very high level. They can be very intuitive, very empathic with regard to other people, especially their emotions.
After my near-death experience, I came back with a real heightened sense of intuition.
We just look at life a little different. I want to still work. I want to play music as much as I can. And I want to help other people because I'm so fortunate.
It's like I'm back to have really outrageous experiences and then turn them into a way to help other people. And thus started the whole idea of having support groups. And now they exist around the world through this organization, the International Association for Near-Death Studies.
I had no idea that there were actually groups of people that got together and shared these experiences.
And as I sat there and listened to some of these people, I'm going, uh-oh. There's other people that get this too.
And it was absolutely wonderful to find this group. And then, of course, the icing on the cake was my meeting Paul when I did.
It has changed my entire life. It changed the way I felt about how I wanted to live my life, how I wanted to fit in.
Kenneth Ring, PhD, had come to town from the International Association for Near-Death Studies to meet near-death experiencers with research potential.
I have had a long time to wonder, what does this all mean?
We're all connected on some level.
I could see how my life was affecting the world.
The point of being here is to love and to grow. And this is school. And there are lessons that we're all supposed to understand.
Well, I think in the overall, for us here, this is just a learning thing. This is just a very small stop on a bigger picture.
Evidence number 9, near-death experiences. Approximately 5% of all people in the USA have had a near-death experience. This is equivalent to over 15 million people. Worldwide, this would be equivalent to over 300 million people experiencing near-death experiences. And this fact is given from scientific studies. 100% of the people experiencing near-death experiences will always experience one or more of these exact same 8 evidences that have been presented in this video. Here is evidence number 9.
If
near-death experiences were culturally determined, then people that had never heard of near-death experiences would have a different experience. But we're not finding that. Whether you know or don't know about near-death experience, the time it happens has no effect on whether the experience happens or not or what the content is.
So based on your data, what is the proof?
Those that are blind, including blind from birth, can have visual near-death experiences.
My research involved a study of young children age 5 and under, and I found the content of their near-death experiences absolutely identical to older children and adults, suggesting that whether you know about near-death experiences, what your cultural upbringing is, what your awareness of death is, doesn't seem to have any effect.
From the video, simply stated, the ninth evidence given by Dr. Jeffrey Lung is as follows. If near-death experiences were culturally determined, then people that never heard of near-death experiences would have a different experience. But we're not finding that. Whether you know or don't know about near-death experiences, the time it happens has no effect on whether the experience happens or not, or what the content is. Other evidences to consider. Dr. Long's research also included young children 5 years old and under, and he found that the content of their near-death experiences was absolutely identical to that of adults.
Putting the ninth evidence into perspective, there are a few people out there who might believe that near-death experiences are a dream or nothing more than an altered state of mind or hallucination due to lack of oxygen to the brain. For the very few people who believe this, ask yourself this question. If the same 5% of people having had a near-death experience in America is applied worldwide, that would be over 300 million people. If approximately 5% of all people living on this earth have had a near-death experience in their lifetime, what are the possibilities that these hundreds of millions of people living on this earth today will experience the exact same events as one another? This would be the same as saying that one night, while millions of people are sleeping or using mind-altering drugs, each would wake up the next morning having experienced the exact same dream or hallucination. The idea and or theory that hundreds of millions of people worldwide would experience the exact same hallucination, unless it were a real experience, is absolutely ridiculous and absurd. It just couldn't happen. This study was done by Dr. Jeffrey Long and many scientists involving extensive research of near-death experiences throughout the entire world. His research of near-death experiences included people from all social, cultural, and religious backgrounds, and all ages of men, women, and children.
Conclusion. Prior to being caught up in the light, a person having a near-death experience is able to observe events and people around them during the time of their death. However, after being caught up in the light, each person who had been greeted by a loved one in their near-death experience reported that the loved one who greeted them was someone who had already passed away from this earth life. Therefore, this proves that the near-death experiences are real experiences and not hallucinations or dreams.
Everybody is going to experience what I experienced at some point. Most of the time, people don't come back from it. It's called dying.
The near-death experience for the entire world, for each and every one of us, is a profound message of hope. That message of hope is we don't really die, that we're going to continue to have a life after we die, and that it's wonderful.
I want to make sure that when my friends go by my casket at the end, I don't want them to say, gee, it looks pretty good. I want them to say, he couldn't have lived another day.
Every exit is an entry to somewhere else. Tom Stoppard. In other words, when one door closes, another door opens for you. The science of near-death studies is undeniable and irrefutable, as explained by Dr. Jeffrey Long.
Dr. Long, in 2010, you published Evidence of the Afterlife, The Science of Near-Death Experiences. New York Times bestseller, a game changer really for science, because the evidence you presented was very straightforward and very compelling. Your conclusion, by every way we can look at it, consciousness seems to survive death for these people, these people who have experienced a near-death experience. But I still get emails all the time from people who don't know that, for example, you investigated people who were blind from birth, and the first and only time they ever regained sight was during a near-death experience, or that you published a medical survey with thousands of participants, or that when you asked them to verify their near-death experience, 96% of them went and verified it and were able to verify that. So can we start there? Can we recap a little bit about that evidence that you uncovered and published in that first book?
I've been collecting data now for over 17 years. All the way back in 1998, the Near Death Experience Research Foundation website came up. Immediately from the day it came up, we had a very detailed survey asking the near-death experiencers a great many questions so that we could learn not only from a large number of near-death experiencers, but learn in depth by drilling down, if you will, to learn with many, many questions exactly what happened during their near-death experience. This is by far the largest near-death experience study that has ever been conducted. And that's exciting, and that's important because that allows us to have more confidence than ever in these groundbreaking conclusions that we'll be talking about today.
Great. And let me add to that with a question about NDE research and this study that you're talking about. So let's let people know, first of all, that you are a full-time radiation oncologist, a cancer doctor. You work for a hospital there in Houma, Louisiana, outside of New Orleans, but you're also a scientist and a medical researcher, someone who, beyond your full-time job, had an interest in this and was able to approach it in a scientific way, like true medical research. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. My medical practice, which I practice full-time, is radiation oncology, which is the use of radiation to treat cancer. I have a very busy full-time practice here in Houma, Louisiana, which is about an hour outside of New Orleans. But in addition to being exceptionally busy in my professional practice, if you will, my second full-time job is doing that near-death experience research. And I've been taking that research very, very seriously, just like I would professional medical research that I do. My professional curriculum vitae is 7 pages long. I've done a lot of research over the years. I take it very, very seriously, and I understand the things that you need to think about, the meticulousness, and the importance of doing it right. So I brought all that skill set into my experience on the research that I did on near-death experience, and that led to with the conclusions I got from the evidence. It was based on the best scientific and medical investigative techniques that we could possibly find for doing this type of research.
And the research that came out of that, I thought, was just stunning. For example, I mentioned briefly a minute ago that you found people that were blind from birth, and yet the first and only time they ever experienced sight was during their near-death experience. You found from a physician, this was really important to you, but you found that people were having near-death experiences during anesthesia, during heavy anesthesia, that was unexplainable. Can you recap some of the most surprising to you as a physician results that came out of that initial research that you did and published in the book, Evidence of the Afterlife?
Sure. I think everybody's got their favorite near-death experience accounts, but perhaps among my most favorite of all time was Vicky. Vicky was born totally blind. And in those born totally blind, vision is unknown and unknowable. And you can't explain vision to somebody born blind in terms of the remaining four senses. I tried it. It's impossible. Vicky was a professional singer, and she was being driven home one day after a performance, and there was a very serious auto accident. So serious, indeed, that she nearly died. The first time Vicky saw herself was when she had her near-death experience. Her consciousness separated from her body, and from a vantage point above her body, she saw herself laying on the gurney below. She didn't know that was her. She was horrified, actually, was her first emotional sense, because vision was so unknown to her for entire life. But it was after she calmed down a little bit and correlated the feel of her long hair, and interestingly, she could feel a ring that a father had given her all her life, and now, for the first time in her life, she was seeing it, and only when she correlated with her newfound sense of vision did she understand that that was her down there. Vicki went on to have an amazingly detailed, highly visual near-death experience. In fact, she described vision in the way many near-death experiencers do, and that's what's called 360-degree vision. That means she can simultaneously see in front of her, back of her, right, left, and up and down. Technically, it's spherical vision, and she was able to simultaneously process that. We've had many, many other near-death experience accounts that describe that exact same thing. Interestingly, talking to Vicki later, she assumed everybody on the planet had spherical vision like she experienced, because remember, she'd never known vision in any other way. And to this day, I think she has a hard time grasping how the rest of us have sort of a pie-shaped visual field and don't really see things the way she did that one time, that one amazing time during the near-death experience that she had.
So great. And let's pack that back into the broader results that you have, because that's one account. And one of the things you'll hear from people who are not very open to the near-death experience science, the kind of stuff that you do, is they want to pick apart cases and say, gee, that's an anecdote and that's just one case. What I think you've done, and maybe you want to explain, because you did say you do this meticulous research, you know, for a medical survey, you're asking 150 questions, you're correlating, there's questions that are duplicate to see if they answer it the same way, there's other little tricks that you do, you're reviewing it as a medical professional to see if it's real. So you have in these surveys kind of two aspects of it. One, data that you can correlate like a good medical scientist would, and then you have these narrative descriptions, which are super powerful and important, but tell us how you use both of those tools to kind of come to your conclusions.
Well, again, being very meticulous and cautious in my research, one of the first things you have to do is make sure that the experience is valid. We ask many questions in our 150-question survey in a redundant fashion. That means basically the same question worded slightly differently at a different part of the survey. That way we can match up the responses and make sure that they line up, that they're sharing the same responses to the same basic question. Second, very important thing when I review near-death experiences, I'm a physician. I've done this now thousands of times. For me, it's relatively easy to see if the life-threatening event that they described and the medical treatment they got and the subsequent medical recovery from that close brush with death, does that really add up medically? And it's very easy for me to make that determination, again, because as a physician, that's my bread and butter. So those are sort of the reality checks that we do on each and every near-death experience to make sure that when we post it on the website, when we use it in our research, we can be crystal clear from very careful inspection that, yes, this is a near-death experience. It really happened.
So, Dr. Long, let me probe a little bit further about the types of near-death experience research that's out there. Because over the years, I've interviewed a lot of near-death experience researchers. And, for example, you know, just the other day, I interviewed this guy, nice enough guy, University of California. He's doing his postdoctorate fellowship. He's part of a team. They receive $4 million. Templeton Foundation to study near-death experiences. So I speak to him about his research. Turns out he didn't really do any original research. He didn't go into a hospital, into a cardiac arrest ward, and talk to patients there. He didn't, as you did, develop a 150 medical survey and give it to hundreds of near-death experience researchers. Yet he published his results. We talked about his book. He concluded that near-death experiences aren't real in the way that we're talking about. They don't suggest that consciousness seems to survive bodily death. So I guess the question is, for the average person who's trying to sort through this idea of near-death experience science research, How do they sort through it? How do they know what research really holds up out there?
The key thing is to know a few of the consistently seen elements of near-death experience that are the strongest evidence for their reality. For example, when you're under general anesthesia, it should be impossible to have a lucid, organized remembrance at that time. In fact, under anesthesia, you're typically so far under, with general anesthesia, they often have to breathe for you. I mean, you're literally brain shut down to the level of the brainstem. And at that point in time, some people have a cardiac arrest. Their heart stops. And of course, that's very well documented. They monitor people very carefully that are having general anesthesia. So I have dozens and dozens of near-death experiences that occurred under general anesthesia. And at this time, it should be, if you will, doubly impossible to have a conscious remembrance. And yet they do have near-death experiences at this time. And they're typical near-death experiences. They have the same elements and appear to have them in the same order as near-death experiences occurring under all other circumstances. And in fact, a critical survey question I asked was what their level of consciousness and alertness during the experience was. Well, even under general anesthetics, under those powerful chemicals to produce sedation, if they had a near-death experience under general anesthesia, their level of consciousness and alertness was identical to near-death experiences occurring under all other circumstances. There's absolutely no way the skeptics can explain that away. It's impossible. That in and of itself is some of the strongest single line of evidence that near-death experiences have to be independent of brain functioning. There's simply no way you can be under general anesthesia and have a highly lucid, organized experience like that, and especially one that's consistently seen throughout near-death experience research. So that's probably the strongest line of evidence we have that the physical brain, as we know it, simply cannot produce the near-death experience.
Okay. And I'm going to push that a little bit further because here's where I was trying to lead you, really, because this has come up over and over again with me, Jeff. I'm not making this up. You know it because you see it out there. I mean, here's a book with all these academic credentials and you dig into it and they never spoke with a near-death experience, someone who actually had a near-death experience. I've had this happen over and over again. I can think of three or four in the last year where I've interviewed him, and I just want to scream and go, how is this near-death experience research? There's no people who had a near-death experience.
But, you know, that is an amazingly good point. It is astounding to me, too, that we have people that publish, write books, write scholarly papers about near-death experience that have literally never talked to someone who had a near-death experience. That is some of the most bizarre research I can possibly imagine. It makes no sense to me, and I'm sure everybody that sees this video is going to think, gosh, how is that even possible? How can somebody claim that they're doing near-death experience research and never, ever even talk to someone who had a near-death experience? Well, the answer is you can't. If you're going to investigate near-death experiences, you have to talk to the near-death experiencers, and you have to understand what happened during the near-death experience. You have to look at the evidence, as I've published, for their lines of evidence that all converge on the validity. That's what really matters in assessing the reality of near-death experience, not the hypotheses that these other researchers generate about how near-death experiences might occur. That's ridiculous. What really matters is, here's what happens during a near-death experience. Here's the evidence for the reality. Can you refute that evidence or not? And with regard to the skeptics trying to refute the evidence for the reality of near-death experiences, they haven't come close. They simply cannot explain away all of the lines of evidence that for near-death experience that me and so many other near-death experience researchers so consistently see.
Medical and scientific proof of life after death. Pam Reynolds' miraculous near-death experience is one of the well-documented medical and scientific cases proving that there is life after death.
The operation Pam was about to undergo was known as Operation Standstill. Pam's body temperature would be lowered to between 10 and 15 degrees centigrade. Her heart and breathing stopped, her brain waves flattened, and the blood drained from her head. She would be clinically dead for a whole hour of the operation.
What we want to do is we want to bring that brain to a halt. We don't just want the brain to be asleep.
We want the metabolic activity of the brain to stop. Every measurable output that the body puts out really disappears completely, so that you have no measurable neuronal activity whatsoever. Prior to the operation starting, a lot of activity goes on. The patient is put to sleep. The eyes are taped shut. There are little clicking devices put in each ear in order to monitor the brain. The patient is then completely covered. The only thing that's really exposed is the area of the head where we work.
I don't remember an operating room. I don't remember seeing Dr. Spetzler at all. I was with a fellow. One of his fellows was with me at that time. After that, nothing. Absolutely nothing. Until the sound. And the sound was unpleasant. It was guttural. It was reminiscent of being in a dentist office. And I remember the top of my head tingling. And I just sort of popped out of the top of my head. And I was then looking down at the body. I knew it was my body, but I didn't care. My vantage point was sort of sitting on the doctor's shoulder. I remember the instrument in his hand. It looked like the handle to my electric toothbrush. I had assumed that they were going to open the skull with a saw. I had heard the term saw, but what I saw looked a lot more like a drill than a saw. It even had little bits that were kept in this case that looked like the case that my father stored his socket wrenches in when I was a child. And I remember distinctly hearing a female voice saying,
"We have a problem. The arteries are too small.
Try the other side."
It seemed to come from further down on the table. I do remember wondering, what are they doing? Because this is brain surgery. And what had happened was they accessed the femoral arteries in order to drain the blood. And I did not understand that.
In the process of my study, I went and interviewed Dr. Spetzler and looked at his operative report, and I found that what she saw from her out-of-body experience seemingly corresponded very accurately to what had actually occurred. She looked at the bone saw that was being used to cut open her skull. I didn't have any idea what this thing looked like. She described it as an electric toothbrush, which I thought was ridiculous. I had to send off for a picture of this saw to Fort Worth, Texas to confirm whether or not what she said it looked like actually was accurate. And I was astounded when I saw the picture. It indeed does resemble an electric toothbrush.
I don't think that the observations she made were based on what she experienced as she went into the operating room theater. They were just not available to her. For example, the drill and so on, those things are all covered up. They're not visible. They were inside their packages. You really don't begin to open until the patient is completely asleep so that you maintain a sterile environment.
She also heard a conversation during the operation between Dr. Spetzler and the cardiovascular surgeons who were cutting into her legs to hook her up to the heart-lung machine. When the cardiac surgeon incised her right groin, she found that her veins and arteries were too small, and she had to go over to the left side. And there was some conversation at the time between the doctors. Pam accurately recalled hearing that conversation.
At that stage in the operation, nobody can observe, hear in that state. And I find it inconceivable that your normal senses, such as hearing, let alone the fact that she had clicking modules in each ear, that there was any way for her to hear those through normal auditory pathways.
So again, this is very suggestive of the fact that there was some sort of extrasensory perception or out-of-body experience or whatever occurring at the time that was allowing Pam to hear accurately and seemingly see accurately what was going on in the operating room at the time.
I felt a presence. I sort of turned around to look at it. And that's when I saw the very tiny pinpoint of light. And the light started to pull me. And there was a physical sensation to the pulling, and I know how that must sound. Nonetheless, it's true. There was a physical sensation, rather like going over a hill real fast. Tummy. And I went toward the light. The closer I got to the light, I began to discern different figures, different people, and I distinctly heard my grandmother call me. She has a very distinct voice. And I immediately went to her. And it felt great. And I saw an uncle who passed away when he was only 39 years old. He taught me a lot. He taught me to play my first guitar. And I saw many, many people I knew and many, many I didn't know. But I knew that I was somehow in some way connected to them. At some point in time, I was reminded that it was time to go back. Of course, I had made my decision to go back before I ever laid down on that table. But, you know, the more I was there, the better I liked it. And my uncle was the one who brought me back down to the body. But then I got to where the body was, and I looked at the thing, and I for sure did not want to get in it because it looked pretty much like what it was, as in void of life. And I knew it would hurt, so I didn't want to get in. And he kept reasoning with me. He says, it's like diving into a swimming pool, just jump in. No. What about the children? You know what? I think the children will be fine. Honey, you've got to go. No. He pushed me. He gave me a little help there. It's taken a long time, but I think I'm ready to forgive him for that. But I landed. I saw the body jump. I saw it do this number, and then he pushed me, and I felt it do this number.
This is a classic near-death experience occurring under extremely monitored medical conditions where every known vital sign and basically every clinical sign of life and death was being monitored at the time. And that's what makes her case so remarkable and so valuable to us.
I don't have an explanation for it. I don't know how it's possible for it to happen, considering the physiological state she's in. At the same time, I have seen so many things that I can't explain that I don't want to be so arrogant as to be able to say that there's no way it can happen.
Pam's case points to the fact that somehow she was able to retain coherent perception and memory whilst clinically dead. This suggests the possibility of some kind of mind-brain separation.
When the heart has stopped and the brain is not functioning, it really is not functioning. There can be no memory. It can't be remembering experiences in some way which are occurring at that time because the memory circuits don't work. So when the near-death experiencer talks about these memories of going out of their body and seeing the resuscitation process, it's difficult for our current neuroscience to understand how this could happen in using a memory system which is defunct.
Chapter 3. Near-death experiences of credible people with diverse religious and cultural backgrounds from around the world. You will see, just as there is a process of a baby being born, there is also a process of what people go through when they pass on to the other side. Race, cultural, or religious affiliation does not determine their experience.
Chapter 3. Signs of God. NDE Number 1. Atheist neurosurgeon Eben Alexander has a near-death experience. Eben Alexander had a brain disease, meningitis, that was so severe it caused him to become mentally incapable of having any kind of cognitive brain function. Prior to his NDE, his brain was absolutely incapable of producing visions, hallucinations of any kind, or of any thought whatsoever. In other words, he was essentially brain dead.
2020 continues. Is there proof of heaven? Once again, Elizabeth Vargas.
8 million Americans claim to have had a near-death experience, but neurosurgeon Eben Alexander never thought in 1,000 years he would be one of them.
What did you think those were?
Fantasies, hallucinations.
He was a man of science. He didn't believe in it. That is, he says, until it happened to him.
Let's talk about how you got sick. You woke up in the middle of the night feeling ill and in pain.
It was like being struck by a freight train. 4:30 in the morning, woke up. Never had anything like that before. My last words to my wife, don't call 911. You know, trust me, I'm a doctor. It's just a muscle spasm. And I was gone.
Dr. Alexander had a rare and deadly form of bacterial meningitis, which was infecting his brain. In a matter of hours, this healthy man was on death's door. By the time they got him to the hospital, he was in a coma.
So your wife was being told that you might die?
And that she would be raising our two boys without me.
But as his body lay in that hospital bed with no recognizable brain activity, Dr. Alexander says he had already begun an astounding journey. A journey to a place he'd said didn't exist.
Did you believe in heaven?
When I was younger, I thought a heaven and a loving God made sense. But through my academic neurosurgery career, I saw less and less that that could be the case.
The journey began, he says, in a dark, formless place without memory, language, or time. But then...
I was rescued from that by this spinning melody of light that came closer and opened up and was a rip in the fabric of reality that just opened up around me.
You described this world as hyper-vivid.
The colors were extremely vivid, with millions of butterflies. And these flowers blooming, blossoms opening as we flew by.
And by his side, an unknown presence.
There was a person guiding you, a beautiful girl, as you describe her. Tell me what she looked like.
She had a beautiful face with a wide smile and high cheekbones and absolutely gorgeous, clear blue eyes. She never said a word to me. She would look at me and the thoughts would come directly into my mind, into my awareness.
What thoughts?
And the thoughts were, you are loved, you are cherished. There's nothing you can do wrong. I always remember being told, we will teach you many things, but you'll be going back.
Back to the hospital where his wife kept her vigil and his doctors were giving up hope. On the seventh day of his coma, he opened his eyes.
It was just nothing but a miracle.
His first words, the very words he'd heard from his guide, that blue-eyed girl.
All is well. Don't worry. All is well.
Within weeks, Eben Alexander had made an astonishing full recovery.
How are you different after going through this experience?
Well, my family says I'm nicer.
That's a good thing.
really has changed me in every way by realizing that our souls are eternal.
The book he has written, Proof of Heaven, has sparked a lot of controversy.
You know, you do have skeptics out there who are just saying it's not uncommon for people near death to have all sorts of funky things going on inside their bodies.
Well, that's why the fact that I had meningitis that was so severe, I mean, that should not have allowed for any experience.
And then this with the eyes just shows how
his brain was so completely shut down that the visions he had could simply not have been generated there. He says he wrote down everything he remembered, now in his book, before speaking to anyone so as not to taint his memory.
You then went on to read about other people's near-death experiences. Was it striking how similar what you had written was to what they had experienced?
It was absolutely astonishing.
I really felt the white light was God.
I stopped walking and I saw my grandma.
You could see peace, you could see love.
And all the other afterlife stories, everybody told of being guided by a loved one who had died. You had as your guide a girl you'd never met.
I must say that was very haunting. Why would I go through all that and not have my father there? My father, who was a neurosurgeon, I idolized him, and he had passed over 4 years earlier. Why wasn't he there?
And why the blue-eyed girl instead? Dr. Alexander had been adopted as a child. Years later, he found his birth family, all except for one, his birth sister, who died before he met them.
Her name was Betsy.
How old was she when she died?
She was 36 years old.
So Betsy you'd never met?
I just heard what a beautiful, loving soul she was. How she worked in a rape crisis center and took care of many people who were unfortunate. And she was just very loving. Mm-hmm. Loving person.
How was it that you came to see a picture of her?
My birth sister, Kathy, had promised to send me a picture of Betsy. And it was about 4 months after my coming out of the hospital when that picture arrived.
He opened the envelope and saw it for the first time. The photo, he says, was of that blue-eyed girl from his vision.
And it was so stunning. And that picture was almost as if she's saying, "Do you get it now?" And I cannot tell you how powerful that was. There was no mistaking it. That's exactly who it was.
Life is back to normal at the Alexander household these days. There are soccer games to watch, dinners to be shared, grace to be said. But Dr. Alexander says he's on a mission now.
I hope to tell my story to everyone I possibly can around this world, because I think it will help this world to be a much better place.
Chapter 3, Signs and Proof of God. NDE number 3, famous actress Sharon Stone shares her NDE.
So tell us, I'd read that you had one of those near-death experiences. Is that true?
It is.
It is true.
It is true.
Tell me.
Well, I had that whole white light thing.
You did? At what point?
After the MRI, I was unconscious in the tube, and then when I came out of it and they talked to me, and then I kind of had that thing where it's sort of like passing out, except you pass kind of up.
You pass up?
Sort of, and mm-hmm. You have this big blow up thing, and you know, I don't know how to explain.
I don't know. I never had it, so I don't know. I'm waiting on you to tell.
Anybody here have it? I don't know. Yeah.
So
it's been a while now, so it's it's not as fresh for me. But you have, it's just a lot of white light, and you see people that have passed on, and they talk to you, and then you pop right back into your body, and you're awake.
Uh huh.
And you have I had an incredible sense of well-being, and a sense that it's just so near. It's not a far away or scary thing. And then
you mean death?
Death.
Really?
That it's a very near and
like
safe.
It's a breath away.
Yes, it's just right there.
Really?
And that it's
That's interesting. I've never heard it described that way.
And loving and gentle.
Really?
And okay. And really? There's nothing to be afraid of, and that it's a beautiful, loving, gentle, good. I felt so safe and so okay that all the stuff that I was terrorized when the doctor was standing there with his hand on my head giving me that horrible look, mm-hmm. like, oh.
You're a goner.
Poor you, yeah. You're bleeding into your head and, uh-huh. oh.
Okay.
That gentle, like nobody's rushing around going, okay, let's get the,
yeah.
You know, they like they do on TV.
Yeah.
Get the stuff.
Yeah.
We're gonna get the
there's none of that ER stuff.
Slam it on her stuff. They're just standing there going,
Oh, that's bad.
You.
That's
yeah.
bad.
And you're going, why aren't you
getting the stuff?
Yeah. And you're like, oh, I'm a dead woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. It felt okay and I felt peaceful and serene and like either thing would work out but yet I really was sure that I wanted to live and be with my son.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was a real choice for me.
Chapter 3, Signs of God, Near-Death Experience Number 2. Renowned journalist Bob Woodworth, who had a near-death experience of his own, interviews a psychotherapist and TV personality named Mary Jo Rapini, where she relates being held by God during her near-death experience.
Before the bomb went off, this is what I remember. Iraq, January 2006. The heat inside the armored vehicle and the palm trees lining the road from Baghdad. And then the blast, an improvised explosive device. Instantly, everything went completely black.
There's no hurry. Everybody's fine. Take your time.
When I came to, I didn't remember anything about the blast itself. I learned what had happened from the doctors and from the footage like this of me and my cameraman Doug Vogt being wheeled out of a Baghdad hospital. But I remembered one thing. The minute after the explosion, a memory I described to my wife Lee, and we put it in our book in an instant. The words there best describe what it was like. I was bathed in a calming white light. It was soft, not glaring, and it was peaceful, enveloping. I was floating somehow. I could see my body below me as I hovered slowly, peacefully, and completely without pain. There was no conscious feeling of urgency that I had to go back somewhere. I don't even think I knew I had been attacked or hurt. The white light just felt good, like soft, welcoming arms.
You too.
That minute, that experience, still confounds and intrigues me, but it also inspired me, setting me on a journey to find out what really happened and to speak with others who stepped over the line and came back, like I will do here tonight. I recently spoke to one woman who also had an out-of-body experience.
And all of a sudden, it just came over me and I was in it. I was in that light and I came to this beautiful area. I was terrified to die. But after I submitted to God and said, you know, your will be done, I had such peace with it, much, much different than what I would have thought. I noticed there was this strange light. It's not like any other light you've ever seen. It's not like a studio light or any ceiling light. And when I saw it, I thought, what is that? Is that the tunnel? I entered this room. God held me, and I never saw God's face, but I felt him through my skin. The first thing he said was, you can't stay.
And just like that, Mary Jo says she was pulled back into this world.
I had such a sense of knowingness there. Everything so much made sense. I dropped any judgment. I was so open. And, you know, unlike a dream that is never clear, this was so clear. You can't, scientists who say it's a dream or I beg to differ, it's not that.
Conclusion. The evidence provided in this video proves that our consciousness continues to live after we die. In the last video, Mary Jo Rapini talked about being held by God. The question we should ask now is, are there others who encounter God in their near-death experience? And is there any scientific evidence to support the reality of a supreme being? The good news is that God is real, and there is evidence to support this. Find out more about this supreme being by watching video number 3.